Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel, maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are that cold.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Kathy Bostrom from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Oprah Daily. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Daily. The complex truth about saturated fat. The science is more complicated than the new dietary guidelines would have you believe. Here's a breakdown. It's official. The food pyramid is back, baby. Only it's been flipped upside down, and beef, not bread, is king. That's right. January 7th, Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. unveiled the latest update to the U.S. dietary guidelines. And one of the most striking changes is the rebranding of red meat and other foods high in saturated fat as good for you. You know, the stuff we've been told for years is bad for heart health. Healthy fats are plentiful in many whole foods, such as meats, poultry, eggs, omega-3 rich seafood, nuts, seeds, full-fat dairy, olives, and avocados, the new guidelines state. The consumer-facing website, realfood.gov, repeatedly mentions the benefits of getting protein and fat from meat and full-fat dairy, a departure from previous guidelines, which typically favored lean meat and fat-free or low-fat dairy. The move isn't surprising given Kennedy's long personal crusade to make America healthy again by encouraging us to eat fewer highly processed foods and more full-fat dairy and animal protein. Kennedy himself famously eats meat and anything fermented, which reportedly involves lots of sauerkraut and a possible side of roadkill from his infamous freezer. We are ending the war on saturated fats, Kennedy said at a press conference unveiling the guidelines. To be clear, our body needs fat from food for energy, to help us absorb important vitamins like A, D, E, and K, to protect our organs, and to support healthy cell growth. But no scientist we spoke to for this story advocates loading up on saturated fat. So before you start slathering on the butter and frying your eggs in beef tallow, here's the skinny on saturated fat. What exactly are saturated fats? Saturated fats are a type of fat that's typically solid at room temperature. They're most commonly found in animal products like beef, pork, butter, and cheese, though some plant oils, like coconut and palm, also contain high amounts of saturated fat. Experts have been down on saturated fat for decades, since a series of studies dating as far back as the 1950s and 60s showed that a diet high in it significantly increased your chance of developing heart disease. When scientists looked around the world at populations where saturated fat was high, they saw an over 70% higher risk in deaths from cardiovascular disease, CVD, says Cheryl Anderson, PhD, MPH, a professor and the dean of the Herbert Wertheim School of Public Health and Human Longevity Science at the University of California, San Diego. Anderson was a member of the 2025 U.S. Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, which was convened under the Biden administration to make recommendations for the 2025 to 2030 Dietary Guidelines for Americans. This committee's work appears to have been largely rejected by Kennedy. What's behind the relationship between saturated fat and heart disease? Some small clinical trials demonstrated that saturated fat raises low-density lipoprotein, LDL, or bad cholesterol. High LDL can increase the risk of having a heart attack or stroke. That news raised the alarm, says Anderson. Why the about-face on saturated fats? This is where things get complicated. People started watching their saturated fat intake, but when you take one thing out of your diet, in order to meet a full daily meal pattern, something else has to go in, says Anderson. Scientists began researching those outcomes in the 2010s and found that what you eat in place of saturated fat matters. When people ate more unsaturated fats, like olive oil or avocado, instead of saturated fats, they had lower rates of both CVD and early mortality. But when people replaced saturated fat with refined carbs and added sugars, remember Snackwells? Little to no benefit was found. In other words, researchers didn't always see a decrease in CVD rates when people cut back on saturated fat, which indicates that CVD is not just about one nutrient. Furthermore, studies from this decade suggest that not all saturated fats are equal. Case in point, more and more research suggests that whole fat dairy may not be any worse for your heart than low fat dairy. A study published this past December in the Journal of Nutrition tracked the dairy intake, whole fat versus low fat, of 3,110 people over the course of 25 years. Researchers found that participants who consumed the most whole fat dairy had a 24% lower risk of developing coronary artery calcification, or CAC, the buildup in your arteries that's an early sign of heart disease, than those who consumed the least. They also found that low-fat intake showed no clear relationship, good or bad, with risk of CAC. And while saturated fat is known to raise LDL, it also has complex effects on other CVD risk factors, including high-density lipoproteins, HDL or good cholesterol, and triglycerides, depending on the food source, says cardiologist Dariush Muzaffarian, MD, Dr. PH, MPH, the director of the Food is Medicine Institute at Tufts University. For example, whole fat dairy like cheese may be high in saturated fat, but it has other fat-soluble compounds like vitamin K2 that may reduce disease risk, he says. The role of red meat in heart disease risk is also somewhat unclear. In its report, the 2025 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee acknowledge that not enough evidence is available to draw a conclusion about the link between red meat consumption and CVD risk. Not all red meats are equivalent either, says Jose Ordovas, PhD, a professor of nutrition and genetics at the Gerald J. and Dorothy R. Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University. Processed red meats, like bacon, salami, and cold cuts, contain a lot of sodium and additives that are not good for you, he says. And they're also linked to higher risks of CVD, mortality, and cancer. The unprocessed stuff, meanwhile, offers meaningful amounts of key nutrients like iron, zinc, and vitamin B12. But still, it's all about balance. If you go to the extreme of eating red meat every day, you are depriving yourself of other nutrients that are going to be good for you, Ordovas says. What researchers do have evidence for? When you substitute red meat and dairy with fish, plant proteins like beans and lentils, or whole grains, and replace butter with plant oils, you can lower your risk of CVD. So just tell me straight, how much saturated fat can I eat? Since Americans tend to eat a lot of saturated fat already, and cardiovascular risks can begin to appear in adolescence, Anderson says a good rule of thumb is to limit the nutrient to no more than 10% of your daily calories, and to focus on getting the majority of your nutrition from foods that are good for your heart. That 10% rule is reflected in the new 2025 to 2030 guidelines, too. However, other experts like Dr. Muzaffarian and Ronald Kraus, MD, a professor of medicine who studies dietary fat and cardiovascular disease at the University of California, San Francisco, thinks it's better to focus on the quality of your overall diet rather than just targeting saturated fat. Diets that happen to be low in saturated fats and healthy in other ways should be recommended, says Dr. Kraus. That's something that all of our experts agree on. What truly matters is the overall dietary pattern we choose every day, which should emphasize whole foods and minimal sugars, refined carbs, and ultra-processed products, says Dr. Ordovas, an ethos somewhat reflected in the new dietary guidelines. You can eat fat, just prioritize the unsaturated stuff from plant-based sources, which improves LDL cholesterol and is linked to a lower risk of CVD. With that in mind, Maybe eating for heart health in 2026 looks more like following the Mediterranean or DASH diet, which are heavy on vegetables, fruits, complex carbs, plant proteins, and healthy fats, and light on animal proteins, than fixating on a single number on a nutrition label. As Anderson notes, when you put that pattern together, saturated fat will generally fall as well. And that was The Truth About The Complex Truth About Saturated Fat by Naomi Barr. Up next, when a switch flips in a marriage and you didn't flip it. After over 20 years together, Belle Burden's husband announced out of the blue that he was leaving. Here she looks back on their whirlwind romance and searches for red flags by Belle Burden. The night before he left me, my husband, James, made a roast chicken using our outdoor grill as an oven, standing on our deck in the dark, adjusting the knobs, making sure the temperature stayed at 400 degrees. It came out perfectly, moist and golden brown. After we finished eating, James left the kitchen to make a work call. The girls went to the living room to watch television. Alone, I soaked the pans, loaded the dishwasher, wiped down the table. As I was filling a bucket with water and white vinegar to mop the floor, my cell phone rang, glowing and vibrating on the kitchen island. I didn't recognize the number, so I let it go to voicemail. When my phone pinged to register the message, I put down the bucket and pressed play. It was a man's voice. He sounded young and nervous. He said, "I'm trying to reach Belle." He paused. "I'm sorry to tell you this, but your husband is having an affair with my wife." He gave his name and number. I froze, feeling dizzy. The words didn't make sense. I gripped my phone and pressed the play arrow again, listening to the man's soft voice for the second time. I thought, this can't be true. This must be a mistake. James will explain this. I leaned the mop against the island and went to find him, descending our stairs just as he ascended them. He was coming to find me. He looked anxious, worried. He put his hand on the small of my back and guided me into the guest bedroom, the room set up with Fortnight, with empty packets of cheddar bunnies on the rug. He sat down on the couch. I sat in a chair to his right. There was a long pause, as if he was collecting his thoughts, searching for the right words to make this go away. I thought he would do that. He would make it go away. I waited. He took both my hands, leaned forward, and looked me straight in the eye. He said, "I promise you, this meant nothing. It's over. I love you and only you. I'm so sorry. I'm so embarrassed." I asked, "How long has it been going on?" He answered, "Only a few weeks." I looked down at his hands, at my body, and felt ashamed of my matronly pajamas and my socks, an oil stain from dinner on the thin cotton of my pajama pants. His platinum wedding band on his ring finger looked scuffed from years of wear. My fingers underneath his were bare. I had taken off my rings, including my diamond wedding band the day before. A friend had told me that the virus could hide under rings, evading Purell and soap, so I had pulled them off, dropping them in a jar of jewelry cleaner. For a split second, I thought, did taking off my wedding band cause this? Did I shake something loose in the universe? I don't remember exactly how I spent the next hours. I know I locked myself in the bathroom. I know I called my stepmother, Susan, and told her what had happened. She yelped in shock. I texted two close friends, Maria and Anna. "James is having an affair." They both answered immediately, confused, writing, "What?" They called me in succession. I didn't answer. I curled into a ball on the cold tile and stayed there for a long time. At 3 a.m., I walked through the quiet house and found James sleeping in Finn's bed. He looked peaceful, breathing steadily, like nothing was wrong. I went back to our room and got in our bed, James's side undisturbed. I tried to sleep, but couldn't. I felt leaden with dread. I could not place what had happened with what I knew of my husband, a kind and mild man, a devoted husband and father. I hadn't drawn the curtains, so I saw the sunrise over the lake. I could tell it would be a beautiful day, crisp and sunny. At 6 a.m., James walked into our bedroom fully dressed, in heavy boots and a black parka, the same clothes he'd worn the night before. He was holding a large canvas tote bag. His green eyes were narrowed and icy, an expression I had never seen before, entirely different from how he had looked at me the previous night. Before he said a word, I knew that something, everything, had changed. He said, "I've decided I want a divorce. I'm leaving." As he spoke, I could not absorb what was happening, what he was saying. I thought the end, or the survival, of our marriage would be my choice. He said, "You'll be fine. You're still young." I was 50. The girls were still asleep when he left. When I heard their movements, their steps on the stairs, my door opening, I pulled back James's side of the duvet to make it look like he had slept there. They got in bed with me, warm in their matching monkey print pajamas, their hair tussled with sleep. I tried to smile as they curled against me, hoping I could hide the red blotches on my face. I called James repeatedly over the next 5 hours, while he was on the road, but he didn't answer. He called back when he reached New York. I could hear him park the car in the garage, hand the keys to the attendant, walk down the street. He said, "I thought I was happy, but I'm not. I thought I wanted our life, but I don't." He said, "I feel like a switch has flipped. I'm done." He said, "You can have the house and the apartment. You can have custody of the kids. I don't want it. I don't want any of it." This was not just an affair. This was not just a rejection of me. He was abandoning all of it, and all of us. James and I met in 1998 at Davis Polk, a large corporate law firm in Midtown Manhattan, where we were both associates. I found him handsome, but I was not interested. I could tell he was a typical New York private school kid, the boarding school and Ivy League variety, just like me. And he looked like my father. Blonde, 6'1", lean, with proper shoes, his shirt sleeves rolled up. It was too familiar. The waspy preppiness, too appropriate. My boyfriend at the time was unemployed. He'd lost his job at a news program within days of moving in with me, a decision he pressured me into right after my father's death, when I left the West Village for an apartment on East 85th Street. I was too shell-shocked to refuse him. In April, I was rotated into James's group, Investment Management. My new office was 3 doors down from his, and I was soon assigned to a deal he was running, the IPO of an internet holding company. As we worked together, I was impressed. He was very smart. We often sat side by side working on a document. Once, our hands holding pencils brushed against each other. He was left-handed, I was right-handed. To my surprise, I felt a jolt, a spark. In June, he sent me an email with the subject line, "Going off the record here." It was the dawn of email. Any message was exciting, but this one seemed to glow in my inbox. It read, "Would you be interested in ditching your boyfriend and coming to Greece with me this August?" I waited until the next morning to answer. Something rambling about liking to spend time with him, but no, I could not go. On June 26th, I worked late into the night preparing to leave for a vacation, a hiking trip with Susan, her mother, and my cousin. James walked into my office and shut the door. Without thinking, I stood and stepped from behind my desk. He said, "I just wanted to say goodbye." He paused several feet away from me. After a few beats of silence, we moved toward each other quickly, embracing, kissing, and equal impassioned wanting of each other. The chemistry people talk about, pure physical chemistry, was coursing through me. Something had happened. I had the conversation with my boyfriend that I'd avoided for a year, ending the relationship. It took 10 minutes. The rest of the summer was a blur of weekends in his bed and mine, clandestine encounters behind locked doors at the office, backgammon and gimlets in his loft, late dinners at Barocco, a restaurant a block from his apartment. He brought me to Chinatown and gave me my first soup dumpling and to the oyster bar for my first oyster. After 3 weeks, he said, "Tell me you love me." I did. I went to Greece, accepting the invitation James had extended in that first glowing email. I loved traveling with him. He took care of everything, making hotel reservations, both expensive and dirt cheap, finding great restaurants, bringing me an ice-cold cocktail while I showered. On a ferry from Crete back to Athens, we lay on the floor, our heads on our duffel bags. James asked me if I wanted to have children. I said I did. He said, "We're going to get married. We're going to have a family together." That fall, back in New York, he told me to meet him at the clock in Grand Central at noon, a short walk from our offices. I got there early, circling the information booth, running into a partner who was picking up her train schedule. I saw him descend the stairs. He was wearing a tweed jacket and had grown a beard. My breath caught. He was so handsome. He walked over to me, grabbed me in an embrace, and whispered in my ear, "Will you marry me?" I whispered in his, "Yes." He reached into his jacket pocket and pulled out a sapphire ring, loose with no box, the blue stone encircled with small diamonds. He put it on my finger. He said, "Nothing bad will ever come of this." It was 3 months after our first kiss. The speed of our beginning and the speed of our ending, of his exit, felt like matching bookends. They both came out of nowhere. They both left me reeling. In both instances, he was definitive, certain. There was no gray area. The switch went on, and then it went off. He wanted it. He wanted me. And then he didn't. Were there red flags? The subtle or not subtle warnings I should have seen before we married. The ones people ask me about now, wanting something, anything, to prove that our fate could have been predicted, that the same thing couldn't happen to them. Maybe his teenage arrests. Maybe the tales he told me about all the girls whose hearts he had broken before we met. Maybe his tendency to direct and mine to follow. But these felt like stories of a rebellious boy becoming a responsible man. The normal mysteries of a three-dimensional human being. There is nothing I look back on now and say, how could I have missed that? Other couples I knew then, and know now, had many more flags, redder flags, and they stayed married. And doesn't it all look different? Wouldn't your own story look different if you knew how it was going to end? This is from the book Strangers, A Memoir of Marriage by Belle Borden. And again, that was When a Switch Flips in a Marriage and You Didn't Flip It by Belle Borden. And last, The Science Behind Why You Suddenly Give Zero Bleeps by Ellen Schur. You're in a meeting. Someone says something objectively wrong. And instead of doing your usual dance, the soft correction, the diplomatic phrasing, the careful preservation of everyone's feelings, you just say it. That's not accurate. No cushioning, no apology, no emotional labor to make the truth more palatable. And everyone looks at you like you've grown a second head. Welcome to what I call the great unbleepening, that point in midlife when your capacity to pretend, perform, and please others starts shorting out like an electrical system that's finally had enough. You might think you're becoming difficult, impatient, and a bitter old woman, but here's what's actually happening. Your brain is restructuring itself, doing some overdue maintenance. And thank God for that, because for years, it's been monitoring social cues, calculating risks, suppressing authentic responses, and managing everyone else's emotional experience. This is exhausting work, and as it turns out, it's unsustainable. Dr. Luann Brizendine, a neuropsychiatrist and the author of The Female Brain, explains that women's brains are particularly wired for social harmony and caregiving in the first half of life, driven partly by estrogen and oxytocin. But as estrogen levels shift in perimenopause and beyond, this intense drive to please and nurture begins to diminish. Here's how these hormones work together. Higher estrogen levels increase oxytocin receptor density in your brain, essentially turning up the volume on your oxytocin system and enhancing your ability to read facial expressions and detect emotional cues. And oxytocin, it has been called the herding or binding hormone. When you meet someone you're attracted to, oxytocin surges, increasing trust and promoting bonding behavior. That rush you feel is your neurochemistry saying, pay attention to this person. Estrogen amplifies this effect, making you more attuned to whether someone will be a reliable partner. Pregnancy and childbirth also flood your system with oxytocin. This rewires neural pathways in your prefrontal cortex and limbic system, areas involved in empathy and emotional regulation. But all of this shifts when your hormones change in midlife. After thousands of interactions where you've monitored and managed your authentic social responses, something in your system starts breaking down. Not because you're broken, but because the system was never meant to run this way indefinitely. What else is happening in your brain? Several neurological and hormonal shifts converge in midlife to reset the system. Hormonal recalibration. Prefrontal cortex changes. Accumulated stress response. Cognitive prioritization shifts. The backlash is real, but worth it. Here's the part that makes this transition uncomfortable. Other people don't like it. When you stop performing emotional labor, systems that rely on it start to break down. Suddenly, you're not a team player, or going through something, or changed, said with concern that really means disapproval. But this backlash is proof of concept. It confirms that your people-pleasing wasn't optional. It was required labor that kept everything running smoothly. And when you stop providing it, people notice. But when you lose your filter, that's when the really good stuff comes in. You gain authenticity. You gain time. You gain clarity. You gain real relationships. How to navigate this transition. If you're in the thick of this shift, here's what helps. Name what's happening. I'm not becoming difficult. I'm becoming authentic. My brain is reorganizing around honesty instead of performance. Language matters. The story you tell yourself about this change shapes your experience of it. Expect resistance. When you stop over-functioning in relationships and systems, others will push back. This isn't evidence you're doing something wrong. It's evidence you were doing too much before. Practice the pause. You don't have to swing from people-pleasing to brutal honesty overnight. Notice when you're about to soften, cushion, apologize unnecessarily. Pause. Choose consciously whether to add the cushioning or not. The ultimate gift. You're learning to exist as yourself regardless of external validation. This is spiritual work. The woman who can say, that's not accurate, without apologizing, is the same woman who can eventually face her mortality without flinching. So when someone says you've changed, when they say you're not the person you used to be, when they imply something's wrong with you now, you've changed into someone who's no longer available for performance. And that's not difficult. That's development. And that was The Science Behind Why You Suddenly Give Zero Bleeps by Ellen Schur. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Daily. I'm Kathy Bostrom, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Oprah Daily is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Baby, black gold with a diamond sword. Strength you have in you, girl. I'm the blood.